Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 10102, Samson Bingham Blue. Arguing for the petitioner, Ronald L. Blue. Arguing for the respondent, Jonathan Delaware.
Good morning and aloha, everyone. The court is honored to be here today at Mililani High School as part of our Courts in the Community program. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? All right. Mr. Albu, you've asked to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal, so with 7 minutes to go in your argument, there'll be a green light will come on to give you, let you know that you're beginning to cut into your rebuttal time. Mr. Ortiz, you've asked for a 3 minute warning when we're coming to the end of your argument, so that green light will come on for you with 3 minutes to go. Mr. Albu, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Associate Justices. I am Ron Albu, representing the petitioner, Ku'ulelani Samson, and I'm pleased to be here today. May it please the court, I would like to start with a short, brief overview of the context, the factual context, so that the issues will make more sense as we go through them. Ku'ulelani Samson, I'll refer to her as Ku'ule, went to the bus stop near her home with her friend to see her off on the bus. As they waited, two buses pulled off in the bus lane at the intersection of Farrington Highway and Jade Street. After Ku'ule's friend got on the bus, she proceeded to cross the street when she was hit by a Chevy Blazer. The jury was presented with two conflicting versions of how the collision happened. The facts were hotly disputed regarding, one, whether Ku'ule was in the crosswalk, and two, whether Blazer was going too fast for the conditions and not paying attention to the crosswalk. Our position for the petitioners is that the back of the second bus was protruding out into the townbound lane of Farrington Highway. The first bus was 40 feet long. The second bus was an articulated bus 60 feet long. And because the pavement wasn't long enough for the second bus to completely, it had pulled in with the back end blocking the lane.
Was that ever demonstrated by any evidence that showed that the, your supposition now seems to be that because there wasn't enough room, the bus stuck out. Was there anything to, you know, demonstrate that?
Yes. There was a car directly behind the Blazer. The people in that car both, their depositions were taken. The husband's deposition was read at trial in his absence, and the wife testified.
Well, no, I understand that there was testimonial evidence, but there was testimonial evidence both ways on that point.
What I asked
was whether or not there's something showing absolutely that bus had to be sticking out.
No.
Okay.
No, there's not. Okay. So our point was that was sticking out, and at about the time Ku'ulelani started into the crosswalk, we believe that the Blazer was just ready to come around that bus. And the facts show that there's about 100 feet then a total of bus, plus another 10 to the crosswalk and distance in the crosswalk. To cover that distance at 40 miles an hour would take about 2 seconds. So our position is that when she stepped out in the crosswalk and looked, she didn't see what was behind that sticking out bus. And right after she started across, she looked to her right for oncoming traffic in the other lane. So that's how the accident happened. She didn't know that something was coming. When she heard the screeching of brakes, she looked, jumped, and then she got hit.
Now, one of the critical issues in the case was the speed at which the defendant was driving, correct?
Correct.
And again, one of your points of error that you've raised with us is the exclusion of an oncoming driver's testimony or proposed testimony that she was driving at an unsafe speed. Now, the Intermediate Court of Appeals said that excluding that evidence was harmless because there was a lot of other evidence from which the jury could infer that she was driving at an excessive speed. What is the plaintiff's position with regard to that?
Our position is that there was evidence that could be used to say there was a high speed. However, the defense expert took that evidence, namely the fact of the impact and how far the body was thrown after the impact, and calculated that at the point of impact, the speed of the car was 33 miles per hour. The speed limit at the site was 35 miles per hour. So they could at least argue that she was within the speed limit. Our problem with that is, sure, that's some evidence of speed, but we believe that, and this expert also said that in his opinion, she did not skid before the hit.
Isn't there a significant difference between speed and unsafe speed?
Yes.
Okay, maybe you should address that.
Well, but I think to answer both questions, the issue first of all was the evidence sufficient so that we didn't need our testimony? And my answer to that is no, because the witness, Day, he was the oncoming driver, he had a commercial driver's license, he had been a professional driver, he's very good at evaluating traffic conditions. And his opinion was that this woman was driving too fast. It was unsafe. That is the opinion that was excluded. Now,
Mr. Albuch, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but while you're on that point, what if the testimony of Mr. Day was that in his view, the driving was negligent? Would you consider that that would have been excludable testimony?
If that had been the case, we would have asked the court for an instruction that he could not use the words negligent, but that he could talk about his impression of the speed, because that's exactly what the cases say. The rule itself says it. A lay witness can testify about things within their knowledge and experience if they observe it. And that's what he saw and there are a number of cases which you cited in the briefs that all say witness can say they were going too fast, they can say the golf cart was in the wrong position, it was unsafe. There's a number of cases, and we cited them all in our briefs.
But the Intermediate Court of Appeals pointed to things like the testimony about how far she was thrown as a result of the incident, about testimony, I believe by Mr. Day, that the defendant was traveling at a good speed. You know, why isn't that evidence enough, or at least enough to make the exclusion of the testimony about unsafe speed harmless error?
Because the term itself, good speed, to me what that means is they were going as fast as they possibly could and still be legal. That's what it means to me. What it means to the average layperson, I have no idea. But the term good itself is ambiguous. But when you say unsafe, there's no ambiguity. That is a more powerful word, and when the plaintiff has the burden of proof, they're entitled to have that evidence. The other important thing about that is we were not permitted to use that to cross-examine the expert, because the expert was cherry-picking, and he did not acknowledge that there was a witness who said she was going too fast when he gave his testimony that it didn't matter how fast she was going because there was no time to stop no matter what her speed was. He also said she didn't hit the brakes until after the hit. So there's a lot of things in dispute, and cross-examination, when a witness like this, who we think has done such a poor job, under the rules is critical that it be broad, that we have wide leeway. And we were prohibited from asking about that. We were also prohibited from asking about a photograph in evidence, which the bus driver acknowledged the mark as the place of the collision occurring in the crosswalk. Now, that was another error, because that photograph on which the markings were made was entered into evidence with the agreement of the defense. There was no objection to it going into evidence. So the evidence showed that, in fact, that intersection had the crosswalk where it was indicated in the photograph. No dispute about that. When the bus driver was asked to testify about it, he was asked, is that the scene of the collision? He said, yes, but I honestly don't remember whether or not there was a crosswalk there at that time.
Can you speak to the need for that particular evidence? Because there appeared to have been other eyewitnesses that identified that there was a crosswalk there.
The question, though, was she in the crosswalk when she was hit? Because that was a big point, which we think was kind of a red herring, and I'll address that if I have time. But that was a big point that could have turned the case. It was important for us to show that she was in the crosswalk. And when the bus driver was cross-examined at his deposition and in the Rule 104 hearing, he was asked, if the crosswalk was there, was she in it? And he said, if it was there, she was in it. So he couldn't say she was in the crosswalk for sure of his own personal knowledge, because he couldn't remember the crosswalk. But he could say, if it was there, as shown in the photograph, she was in it.
But Mr. Albu, wouldn't you agree that the analysis of the circuit court under Rule 403 and weighing the probative value versus the prejudicial value acknowledged what you were saying, that this is very important evidence, and the judge determined that didn't appear there was sufficient foundation, the indecision about the witness, about Exhibit 7, was such that the witness couldn't really identify the crosswalk and confirm the crosswalk was there. Wouldn't that mean that in this case it could be considered prejudicial because there wasn't any certainty as to that testimony?
The testimony is absolutely prejudicial, but all important testimony and evidence is prejudicial. That's why we put it into evidence.
I guess the judge seemed to be inferring it was prejudicial because it wasn't necessarily reliable, because that particular witness wasn't sure that there was a crosswalk there.
But he was sure of where the accident occurred, and the evidence, the picture was in evidence, and there's no question that the crosswalk was there where the picture showed it.
You know, following up on what Justice Wilson, it seemed like what the court was focused in on was the reliability of the evidence. And my question to you, under 104, which addresses foundation, or 403, which addresses unfair prejudice, is there anything in there about reliability? Should the court have been weighing whether the court thought how reliable the evidence was? That seemed to be what was driving the court's decision.
Well, my understanding, and I was there, was the court was more concerned about unfair prejudice. He seemed to feel it was unfair, but there was nothing unfair about it. It wasn't like we said she's got a drinking problem or that she'd been cited before for violating the rights of pedestrians. This was right on point. This didn't bring up an issue of emotional dislike of the defendant. It only brought up something that was probative. And you know, it's the brick in the wall thing. Every brick doesn't have to be perfect as long as the wall is strong.
Well, let me ask this question a different way then. Would the court's decision have been the same, do you think, if the bus driver had placed her outside the crosswalk?
You mean the jury's decision?
No, the judge. Would the judge have admitted the photograph if Benson had put her just outside of the sidewalk instead of inside the sidewalk? It seems
I'd have to speculate. I don't know what he would have done. I just don't know. And I mean, you'd have to ask him, really. I don't know.
Mr. Albu, on that issue about the placement of the plaintiff in the crosswalk, it appears from the evidence that during the 104 hearing, there was testimony from the witness, that is the driver of the bus, that he did not make the X, the second X, that put the defendant, that put the victim in the crosswalk. And so I wanted to ask you about that, because it does appear that there is testimony in his deposition in which he seems to indicate that he is putting the X there. So what is your position as to whether he actually did create the second X?
Yeah, my understanding, there were the two X's, as you referred to. One was the accident which she left the bus, and the other one was where the accident occurred. I was not at the deposition, but from reading all the transcripts, my understanding is that he pointed to where the collision occurred, and someone else put the X on the exhibit, and then he was asked if that was the correct location. He said, yes, that was the area where the collision occurred. No, there was an attorney from the bus representing the bus driver, and there was the defense attorney. So there were two attorneys present. None of them objected to his identifying that X as the location. And again, during the Rule 104 hearing, he again said, and the deposition transcript was read to him during the 104 hearing, he said, yes, that was the spot, and yes, that's the spot I indicated. So nobody questioned in the hearing by the bus driver, no one questioned the accuracy of the placement of that X. I wish that he had been the one to draw the X, but I don't see any harm in what happened. It just could have been cleaner.
Mr. Albu, I want to ask you or focus you a bit on the jury instructions which you've challenged, and one of them, you've challenged several of them that the court gave, and they were instructions that were proposed by the defendant. One of them read, a pedestrian is required to obey all traffic laws which are applicable to her. And how, in your view, is that instruction an erroneous statement of the law, or how was it incorrect and prejudicial to your client for the judge to instruct the jury in that manner?
In our briefs, we cited a couple of important Supreme Court decisions which say that it can be error to take a statute and read it to the jury or to paraphrase it improperly. Same thing with language from a court opinion. In this case, we objected to, and the intermediate court found, that one of the instructions was erroneous because a phrase was dropped and it was grammatically incorrect. So it was confusing and hard to understand. That one read, a person starts, a person traveling upon a highway has a right to assume that all other persons using the highway will obey the law and that one is not bound to keep a lookout for others who may violate the law. And then it says applies. It's a word that doesn't fit. And so because something was left out, it makes no sense. And then it goes on to say that the driver of an automobile also, if they don't comply, it doesn't apply if they might be negligent. But it was confusing. But more importantly,
the ICA said they thought that actually helped your client because it emphasized that the rule would not apply if the driver of the vehicle was negligent.
Well, I guess I'd have to disagree with the ICA. It's very confusing. You know, it's interesting. Oral argument happened on Thursday morning. The jury went to lunch, and by 2 o'clock they had a verdict on a Thursday before a three-day weekend. I don't think they spent a lot of time with these instructions.
Well, do you agree with the proposition that as long as someone is following the law, traffic laws, they don't have a duty?
Absolutely
not. To keep a lookout for others who may violate the
law?
This instruction appears to be saying that as long as a person is driving following the speeding laws, it doesn't matter. They can hit a jaywalker.
And that's absolutely wrong, because there is a statute also in the instructions which says Hawaii law requires that every driver of a vehicle shall exercise due care to avoid collision with any pedestrian upon any roadway.
Since the two instructions clearly contradict one another, did any other part of the instruction tell the jury to disregard the one that was false?
No. But there's one other point that's very important I'd like to make. After that first erroneous instruction, the next one was the one that Chief Justice mentioned. A pedestrian is required to obey all traffic laws which are applicable to her. And the one after that, again, both from the defense, a pedestrian who crosses a roadway outside of a crosswalk is required to yield the right-of-way to all vehicles upon the roadway. Now, there is an instruction that says evidence of violation of an ordinance can be evidence of negligence. But again, that's kind of a complicated concept for lay people to get, and it's unnecessary to state an ordinance in this way.
Wait, I have a question. They gave an instruction that said a pedestrian is required to comply with all laws.
Yes.
Did they give one that a motorist is required to comply with all laws?
Not in that language.
And isn't everybody required to comply with all laws?
Yes.
And did they tell the jury what all the laws were a pedestrian has to comply with?
And that's why this goes back to the earlier instruction that's contradictory. That one says the law requires that every driver shall exercise due care. It doesn't say it requires that they shall follow the law. It speaks in negligence terms, due care. And I would submit that someone who is a foot or two outside of a crosswalk may be liable for a traffic infraction, but they're not negligent about anything. She was in an area where the crosswalk was located, where anybody passing two buses stopped on the side of the road or stopped for a reason, and any reasonable driver driving along that highway should have been aware that somebody might come out in front of the bus. Whether or not they're a foot inside or outside the crosswalk is irrelevant. In fact, if there were no crosswalk drawn on the pavement, there would still be a virtual crosswalk there, and there would be no boundaries for it. Why is there a difference? So in my mind, there is no negligence at all. And the fact that these instructions were admitted, where they're stating these things as absolutes, really put the plaintiff at a disadvantage because the jury had all these indications that she really was a bad actor when she was not in the crosswalk, which we don't believe is true anyway, particularly because of that photograph.
Would you think it would be negligent, or would she be violating any statute? The way the buses were parked, it seemed to me that, the way the buses were parked, for her to actually be able to view what was coming, she may have had to get out of the crosswalk in order to see around them. If a person, in order to see, leaves the sidewalk for a few steps, does that mean they're in violation of these traffic laws?
Well, that's the problem. And that's why I say it's not negligence if she did. Plus, there is evidence from Mr. Day that the buses weren't completely pulled off the road. And there's another statute that says when a vehicle is stopped at a crosswalk, you can't pass it. Well, that happened here, obviously. But, you know, it was close. And again, that's one of those things. Is it close enough? Is he far enough off that it's okay to pass him? And these are things that a jury has to deal with. But when you put things in absolute terms, you end up with strict liability or per se negligence, and that's the problem.
Mr. Albee, you're into your rebuttal time. You can continue or you can save it as you wish.
I think we've covered all the major areas, so I will stop at this point unless you have a pressing question. I asked for a couple of extra minutes, so if you have one now, that's the time.
We can wait, and we'll hear from Mr. Ortiz, and then
you can come
back and rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, honorable members of this court, counsel, my name is Jonathan Ortiz. I represent the respondent, Nola Nahulu. I'd like to first thank this court for the honor of allowing us to present our case to you. It's rare when attorneys have this privilege. I also want to thank you for the privilege of having us before these audience of young, bright, potential lawyers out here on the campus of the 2014 Hawaii State Football Champions. We know what the case is about, but just a brief overview, taking a look at the big picture before I get into the areas that are of concern to the court. The jury's decision in favor of Ms. Nahulu was a correct decision, and the ICA's decision affirming that jury award was correct.
Mr. Ortiz?
Yes?
With respect to that jury instruction that we were just discussing, the one that starts that a person traveling upon a highway,
yes, Your Honor,
has a right to assume that all others will obey the law and is not bound to keep a lookout for others who may violate the law, you did not even respond to the plaintiff's arguments in your answering brief. It appears that you actually conceded that instruction was erroneous.
Your Honor, in reviewing that instruction after the fact, it is garbled. We concede that it is garbled. And I've read it 1,000 times maybe, and I can't make heads or tails from it. As a trial judge, you know that these jury instructions are often put together right at the last minute in the heat of battle. And I think what the court tried to do is try to merge two things together. So if you actually look at the instruction, the first part is fine. It deals with both the pedestrian and the driver traveling. They have
actually
a right to
assume. Let me address that first part, because
yes,
the judge actually added things from an old case.
From the Arena case, yes.
From the Arena case. But the instruction that you requested was, a person traveling upon a highway has a right to assume that all other persons will obey the law and is not required to keep a lookout for others who violate the law. Do you really think that is an accurate statement of the law?
Well, it was at the time we submitted it, and it...
On what basis?
On the basis of what a person is required to do either as a pedestrian or as a driver.
A driver is not bound to keep a lookout, is not required to keep a lookout for others who may violate the law. In other words, if you're driving by a school when school gets out, You don't have to look out for children that might be running across the street.
No, I mean, you do.
If you're driving down Waikiki, look, a driver, you don't have to watch out for jaywalkers?
No, a driver always has a duty to keep a proper lookout. But things happen unexpectedly. And in this case, what we have here is a classic dart out. That's what we have here, a dart out.
But so it's the instruction we're talking about.
Correct.
That's faulty. We understand that there's dart outs and things of that nature, but telling the jury that a person can drive, and as long as they're obeying the speed laws, that they don't have to look out is an incredible proposition.
That's not what it says in this instruction, though. That was a requested instruction. That's not what instruction number 6 is.
Well, the way it ended up, it basically says that, ungrammatically, but it does say that as long as you're not violating the law, you don't have to keep a lookout.
Well,
Do you think that should be the law?
No, I don't think it should be the law, but I don't think that's what the intent was.
It doesn't matter what the intent was. It's what it says.
Right. And now the respondent or the petitioner is saying, well, I don't think the jury spent much time looking at the instructions. So I'm not sure what this came into play. I think the facts of where the pedestrian came from.
The jury is instructed that they must follow the instructions.
And there is an assumption that they did.
Right.
Correct.
But, Mr. Ortiz, isn't there also an assumption if there is an error in the instructions that it is prejudicial? And given that assumption, can you explain, assuming that this was error to give instruction 6, why that would not rise to the level of reversible error?
Because the instructions have to fit in with the facts of the case. It's just not some abstract concept. Number 2, the ICA found that while it was ungrammatically or grammatically incorrect, that it actually was of assistance, or was not a detriment to, I guess the way they put it, to the pedestrian. Because it talks about if the driver of the automobile is negligent, then you also waive you really don't have to keep on a lookout. You don't have to assume that everybody's
But the jury
following
could
the
have found that your client did not violate any traffic laws. In other words, the jury could have found that your driver was going 33 in a 35-mile-hour zone, that your driver did not cross the double solid yellow line based on conflicting testimony. I know some people said that your driver did, some people said that your driver didn't.
But with all due respect,
so
I don't...
This instruction says that as long as your client wasn't violating any laws, she had no duty to look out for someone that might be crossing the street illegally.
Well, that's your interpretation, and maybe that's a correct one, but that's not, I believe, what the ICA found. And this idea of this bus sticking out 100 feet away from where, more than 100 feet from where the impact occurred, is a red herring, because the accident didn't happen 100 feet away. There was enough room, the jury must have found, there was enough room for both. Mr. Jawal, who was behind my client, to go past his bus.
Well, how
that's
many
what
feet
they said.
Per second was your client traveling at 33 miles per hour?
Well, she wasn't. That's another misstatement by the petitioner. The expert said no more than 33, the maximum. Now, they take that as the minimum and saying, well, she might, you know. So that's not the case. But, you know, there is a...
Well, even at 25 miles per hour, your client is traveling 36 feet per second, correct? And as your expert said, the reaction time reaction perception time is 1.5 seconds. So she's already traveled 54 feet.
Okay, that's correct, which raises the whole issue as to how this thing occurred. The conundrum for the plaintiff is that you have 3 witnesses who said that this girl was hidden by the bus, and from the safety of that bus, she walked quickly or ran or whatever, right into the flow of traffic, not giving the drivers on that roadway sufficient time to avoid hitting her. Now, her testimony is...
This girl was 14. What if this was a 7-year-old?
Then she should have been with her parents. I mean, I don't understand what that question is. A parent would not allow the child to run in front of the bus, but this person did. This was a bus cutout. It is designed so that traffic on the roadway can drive past the bus so that they don't block traffic.
So,
this is not a school bus.
So as... Drivers should be going up to 33 miles per hour, and that would be okay.
No. The standard is they should be within the speed limit. Now, the conundrum if I could finish.
Wait, isn't the standard not only within the speed limit, but they have to exercise due care in accordance with what the circumstances.
No,
and what the circumstances were two buses, and she said that she was familiar with that area. She knew there was a bus stop. She knew that there was a crosswalk there.
Right.
And she's apparently not decreasing her speed.
No, but that's not. If you look at the transcript, she said that when she comes by buses, she does decrease her speed by taking her foot off of the accelerator, not by braking, but by slowing down.
Except that Day, whose testimony was excluded, had a different conclusion.
Well, Mr. Day testified. What actually came into evidence, if I could just repeat his testimony real briefly, he said, and this is the ICA, this is at the ICA decision, pages 9 and 10. Nahulu came around the bus at a good speed. She hit the girl hard. She could not stop in time. She skidded about 8 feet. She was traveling fast enough to cause damage to the SUV, fast enough to send the girl into the air. The girl flew 15 to 20 feet. And I was driving at a safer speed because I slowed down. He's coming from the opposite direction because he sees the girl. She's not in his blind spot, but this girl is to my client.
Isn't that precisely why a driver passing buses should slow down?
Well, she did. That was uncontroverted. She testified to that. They didn't somehow show that she wasn't.
To the point that when she, at the point of impact, the girl flew how many feet? 15? 40?
It depends on... Yes, in that range. Okay.
Well, Mr. Ortiz, the jury seemed to have found that speed wasn't an issue that would cause them to conclude that your client was negligent. However, as you raised the issue of Mr. Day's testimony, the issue of speed was directly addressed by the testimony that the plaintiff sought to introduce, right? That is that Mr. Day decided that it was an unsafe speed. So,
in his opinion, correct.
If you accept that it was error to have excluded that testimony from Mr. Day of unsafe speed, which goes directly to this issue of how fast they were going, how do you respond to the point of the intermediate court that was harmless error? Because how could it be harmless if it goes to the ultimate issue?
Okay. Quite frankly, when I went to law school, witnesses could not testify as to the ultimate issue. That has changed. I've been practicing a long time, as you can tell.
And I think you worked very hard to keep it out, and successfully so, because you found it was such an important fact, right? His opinion.
Right. But I think in this court, in State of Hawaii versus Ryan, in considering that issue and talking about, in that case it was expert opinion, but it's still opinion testimony. This court said that if you allow people to testify to the ultimate issue, it's not without limits. It says the rule does not allow the admission of opinions which would merely tell the jury what result to reach. Because in that case, we just make Mr. Day the 13th juror.
I'm just trying to get to the point. If you assume that it was error, that actually he should have been able to testify about the ultimate fact, then how can you justify the error by saying it was harmless? I'm interested in your view about
because
that.
Because the jury must have found that this impact did not occur as the plaintiff stated.
Was there any other evidence of an unsafe speed? Did anybody testify specifically to it being unsafe?
No. Okay. The law establishes the appropriate speed, which would be 35 miles per hour. She is traveling under that. So at least there's a presumption that she's traveling at a safe speed. The road designers know that there's a bus cutout, that there's going to be pedestrians coming off of this bus. And they put the cutout there specifically to allow vehicles to travel past that bus at 35 miles per hour, and knowing that there is a bus stop 10 or 12 feet ahead. They know that. So what is the driver supposed to do? Just make something up, say, well, you know what? Just in the off chance that some kid may come running in front of this bus, I'm going to slow down? I don't get it. Now, if there was a pedestrian waiting at the crosswalk like the plaintiff tried to get the jury to believe, then perhaps we have something.
Well,
but
Mr.
that's
Ortiz,
not the facts of the case. Yes,
you,
Justin.
But you said that your client reduced her speed.
Correct.
So that
she's
has
a
to
safe
be
driver.
A reasonable thing to do. You just said it's not reasonable to reduce your speed.
Well, it's not required. But it was reasonable because that's the way she operated her vehicle that day and on all days when she passes that or that place where the bus was.
You've acknowledged then, if there are buses stopped, even though the speed limit is 35, it's reasonable to reduce your speed because passengers will be coming
out. It's actually reasonable to reduce your speed anytime.
Right, and there's a crosswalk there, right? There's no dispute. There actually was a crosswalk.
Well, not, but see, the plaintiff is trying to make this fantasy by this phantom X that the impact occurred while this plaintiff was walking across the road in the crosswalk.
What do you mean that's not a phantom X? It wasn't, if I remember right, in the deposition, I thought it was the lawyer for the defense that actually shows the picture, asked them.
Oh, no.
Wait. The first X about where the bus was was asked by your counsel and by you folks bringing the picture to the bus drivers. Then they asked, well, can you also place where she was hit?
Okay.
And then, all of a sudden, you're trying to disavow that picture.
Well, with all due respect, and, you know, it's been 4 years or so since I tried this case, and I forget what was actually said at that deposition exactly. And why I call it a phantom X is because what Mr. Benson testified to was that the impact that the girl walked in front of his bus and almost at an angle towards Jade Street, and she was hit about 6 feet in front of his bus. The bus stop is 10 feet. Now, if a person is walking right at the edge of a crosswalk, it's as if they're in the crosswalk.
Well, Mr. Ortiz,
but Ryan,
what if there was no marked crosswalk? Does it even matter?
It does matter because this girl...
Why? What is the definition of a crosswalk under Hawaii law?
It's where you cross the street legally. It could be. It has to.
Does
be
it have to be marked?
No, it has to be a mark if it's a continuum of a road that you can't go across. So if there's a T intersection, you get to the T and there's no crosswalk, then there's an implied crosswalk. That's where you would have an implied crosswalk, not here. So there would be no expectation.
This was not a T intersection.
It was, but not that. But the crosswalk was before that. So the T intersection would have been further down the road.
Oh, okay. So what if she was a little further down the road and started crossing?
Then she would have seen my client would have seen her, and we wouldn't be here.
Do we know that?
We know that because the evidence is that this girl darted out from the front of the bus, which was in the bus cutout, not at that crosswalk. That's the point.
Well, you know, you're back focusing on the point she was not in the crosswalk. However, in the deposition of Mr. Benson, the driver,
yes,
there are two places in which he indicates where the in the deposition of Mr. Benson, he addresses the issue about the crosswalk, and you've indicated that a large part of your argument at trial was that she wasn't in the crosswalk. But in his deposition, he says in two different places that the incident occurred in a certain spot that he points to, and then he agrees with the X that's put there, the second X. So I wanted to ask you about the decision of the circuit court to exclude Exhibit 7, where the testimony of Mr. Benson was that this particular photograph, and this is what he said at the 104 hearing, he said, Exhibit 7 represents the scene of the accident at the time of the collision. So if he agrees that it represents the scene, but he can't remember if the crosswalk is there, and you have three other witnesses that remember the crosswalk was there, wouldn't that be sufficient foundation for admission of this evidence, which you concede is quite important?
Look, this is a picture of the accident scene. Nobody's disputing that.
Yes.
What happens with a two...
In fact, you have extra photograph, Exhibit B3, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. But...
That was admitted into evidence. Another photograph admitted into evidence showing the same thing.
Without the X. And the problem with a two-dimensional photograph is that it distorts images to the point when you cannot determine the proximity of one item.
Was that the reason the court left it out, said it distorted? Was there anything about distorting? I thought the reason was the judge said, well, and the judge even asked some questions in the 104 hearing, and the question was, you don't remember. It was all based, if the bus driver, for example, had forgotten that there was a traffic light or a manhole cover, are there certain things that one has to remember in order to establish a foundation for a photograph?
If you're going to say that's where the point of impact was.
He was clear about the point of impact. What he forgot was whether or not there was a crosswalk. There was no question about his definite testimony as to the location, and that's what was not admitted.
It was established at trial that the bus stop, or I'm sorry, the crosswalk was 10 or 12 feet away from where the end of his bus was, all right? And that was established by the manhole cover, which is right at where the crosswalk begins. He said she was struck 6 feet in front of his bus, which means that she has another 4 or 6 feet getting to the crosswalk. But the real important issue here, if I could just concentrate on this point, is that it's not as if she were waiting at the crosswalk, took a look down the road and saw that it was clear and my lady came barreling around the bus. That's not the facts of this case, or at least that's not what the jury found. The facts are from Mr. Day and from Mrs. Joao and from Mr. Benson that she was walking briskly, and it only takes, you walk 6 feet per second, so it's two steps into the oncoming traffic when she gets hit.
But
that's
aren't
what
you,
the jury found.
Aren't you suggesting that regardless of whether there was a crosswalk, she was negligent?
The plaintiff?
Yes.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
Because
however,
she wasn't in the, but if she were
however,
in the,
isn't that a matter of just weighing the evidence? Why wouldn't the jury be permitted to look at this photograph showing that there was a crosswalk and make a determination on their own whether she was in the crosswalk or not?
Because what the circuit court judge said is that at that point, let's assume that the foundation were laid.
But wasn't it laid? You had a number of different witnesses that identified the fact there was a crosswalk, and you had the testimony, as I said, of the witness who said this photograph, Exhibit 7, depicted the scene at the time of the accident.
Well, this court at State versus Sequin, 73 Hawaii 331, where you had the same picture of
yes,
the aerial photograph.
Yes, but Sequin was an instance in which it was a photograph that was, by the account of all the witnesses, unclear, and there was another photograph that was a sufficient substitute. And in addition to that, you didn't have three witnesses that essentially identified the scene.
Well, the point is not so much the scene, but where she was when she got hit. The plaintiff said, I walked in the Honolulu direction away from the bus. I got to a pole. I stopped. I turned. I looked. I got waved on through the crosswalk by a mystery white car that nobody could identify.
But actually, all of this goes to the plaintiff's alleged contributory negligence, correct?
No.
And we're actually dealing with the fact that the jury found your client not negligent. So the issue is whether or not the instructions were correct on the law as to the duty of care owed by your client.
We attached as an Appendix A to the answering brief all of the instructions that were given. And if you read those, it is a correct interpretation of Hawaii law.
I want to bring you back to exhibits to your,
I'm sorry?
Your proposed instruction 6, which I believe you said was garbled. At least you acknowledged that it was garbled. How is it that instruction, garbled as it was, how can we be confident that the jury read all the way through it and interpreted it the way you say that they should have interpreted it, which is not to state the broad proposition that if you're following, you know, if you can assume that others will not be violating the law.
I think we have to look at all of the jury instructions as a whole. And when you read everything together in light of the facts that were presented to this jury, they followed the law.
But the problem—
yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Looking at the instructions at one place they say the driver has a duty to look out at all times, and then at another point in the instructions it says the driver doesn't have a duty to look out if they're following.
So
them.
If we
so
assume—
How do we know the jury's going to figure out what's correct in the court's instructions?
Because that is why we have the system where jurors are allowed to submit questions. They could write a note saying, Judge, we don't understand these. Can you explain it to us again? There were no jury questions in this case. They understood what the law is. They understood the instructions that were given, even if there were a conflict.
Well, you're assuming they understood it. There is a presumption that an erroneous instruction is prejudicial, and when you look at this instruction, it seems to be somewhat of a go-for-it instruction in the sense that the driver who is complying with the law confronted with a person, as you contend the plaintiff was, confronted with a person who is not in the crosswalk, moving very fast, therefore acting negligent in violation of the traffic laws, that person doesn't really enjoy a level of duty from the driver to watch out for her. It's a go-forward statute in the sense that if it's a pedestrian not complying with the laws, they might be in jeopardy.
I appreciate that point. It's a fair point. But those aren't the facts of this case.
But that is how the judge instructed the jury. Correct. And let me ask you, do you really think that should be the law?
No.
Can you address that instruction? I think it's number one. A pedestrian is required to obey all traffic laws which are applicable to her.
In terms of what?
In your view, should that instruction have been given? And why wasn't it given with respect to a motorist? And is a jury supposed to know all laws?
All right. I think what the court does when you give instructions is all of the laws that the court deems to be applicable to the facts of that particular case. So the jury, when they're given the law by the judge, it's assumed that they are listening to those instructions and will apply them. They're not to know every single law. I mean, nobody knows all of that.
But suppose the jury might have thought that they... since this says a pedestrian is required to obey all traffic laws, is there a traffic law that says a pedestrian is required to look both ways before they enter to the street?
I don't believe so.
Would a jury know that? There was a big deal made about her walking diagonally. Is that against the law to walk diagonally?
Well, there's no law against walking diagonally unless you're trying to run yourself into the middle of traffic from in front of a bus.
Are you aware that there's a statute that says pedestrians shall move whenever practicable upon the right half of crosswalks? In other words, pedestrians are required to go diagonally in a sense to go to the right side of this crosswalk.
Yeah, I'm aware of that ordinance and the traffic code, but that really has nothing to do with this particular event.
Well, the problem is when you tell a jury that a pedestrian is required to obey all laws and you don't tell them which laws, they're going to be guessing what the law is.
Except that the law is given to them, and if you would read all of the instructions in total, the totality tells them all they need to know to decide this case. Now, I concede that the latter half of that instruction is garbled. But to answer your first point, the first part of your question having to do with was that a proper instruction, and was there one given for the driver, most of the jury instructions had to do with the driver's duty to keep a proper lookout, to drive at to look out for pedestrians, to assume there will be pedestrians, to drive at a safe speed. So all of those instructions as to what is required of the driver were given. All of these jurors are drivers. They're all pedestrians as well.
Mr. Ortiz, do you think it makes a difference that it was phrased for the plaintiff having to obey all laws, but for the defendant, just that the defendant has to use due care? And never actually saying the defendant is required or the driver is required to obey laws?
I'm not sure that an instruction that specific was requested by the plaintiff. So if it wasn't, now I understand the court has to give the correct instruction even if the counsel do not request it. But that certainly was not, to the best of my recollection, now I haven't memorized the entire record. But I don't believe that was requested by the plaintiff. And quite frankly, I would not have objected if they had requested one. If they were going to give one for the defense, for the pedestrian, they should give one for the driver. It wasn't requested. All right. Any other searing questions?
No. Anything to wrap up for the court, Mr. Ortiz?
Once again, let me just... thank the court for the opportunity of presenting our case here. And, you know, I really appreciate the jury system. It's the bedrock of our system. And I believe here, if you take a look at the big picture, Ms. Sampson had a full and fair trial. But there's no perfect trial. Judges aren't perfect. Attorneys certainly are close to perfect, but not quite. But here, in my view, there was no egregious error which produced an erroneous result. I think substantial justice was done, and we asked that verdict.
Is egregious error our standard that we apply?
No. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ortiz. Mr. Albu, your rebuttal.
Thank you. I think I can be pretty brief. There's one very important factor here. The expert said he relied for his opinions almost primarily on the bus driver Benson. He said that the fastest that the driver was going was 33 miles an hour because she did not skid before hitting the plaintiff. She swerved. And he said he knows that because she couldn't steer if she were skidding. So he made all this stuff up based on an assumed accuracy of the bus driver. But Benson also said that she skidded 40 feet. Day said she skidded 8 feet. Benson said she was 6 feet away from the bus when she was hit. But the photograph shows that she was almost all the way across a 10-foot crosswalk. So is he lousy at estimating distance? You know the old saying, a picture's worth 1,000 words? At least with a picture, you could go out there and you could get a tape measure and measure it. So Benson is not a good estimator of speed or distance. He said that she got hit a second after she went out. Well, our calculations, if it's going 40 miles an hour, is 68.67 feet per second. She could cover that in 2 seconds. Is he so accurate that he can tell a difference between 1 and 2 seconds? I don't think so.
Are you suggesting that you didn't have an adequate opportunity to cross-examine the faulty opinion of the expert?
We couldn't because the photograph was excluded and Benson's testimony about unsafe speed was excluded. So we were very limited on cross. With someone who, at least if we followed the Supreme Court's thing, the judge is supposed to be the gatekeeper.
How much difference would it make if the expert was questioned about a statement by Benson that it was unsafe? Isn't that sort of a vague term? How would the expert have been able to be challenged just on this notion?
Traveling at an unsafe speed is one factor to consider. This is a CDL bus driver, a CDL driver, excuse me, with experience commercial driving. He said she was going too fast. She was going at an unsafe speed. That's a factor to be considered.
How do you think that would have changed the expert's opinion?
If you add that, plus the fact that Benson marked the crosswalk and that was not allowed in evidence, we could have taken her out of the crosswalk thing and done away with all those lousy instructions. And the jury could have focused on the real facts of the case. Was there negligence when she was hit in a crosswalk? We don't know what the jury decided. The verdict didn't ask that. It only asked the first question. That's where it ended. She wasn't negligent. We don't know why they said that.
Mr. Alview, can you address Mr. Ortiz's waiver argument?
Waiver of?
That any objection you might have to the unfair emphasis on the pedestrian obeying the law, but not on the defendant, you didn't preserve that.
I don't understand what we waived.
The argument that the instructions were erroneous because it phrased the pedestrian's duty in so.
Oh, that was given over our objection. We would never make such an offer of an instruction because they're not to be made. This court has said that you shall not use the starting point of a statute or a court opinion. You need to instruct the jury in lay language that's understandable. And when you talk about requirements, you're already violating what this court has already said you shouldn't do. So that's the answer to that. But we did object to those instructions. They were not part of the standard court instructions. The court instructions, standard ones, would have been fine. But this is a red herring, as I said, this stuff about not in the crosswalk, that's not negligent if she was a foot out of it. But the court never got to her negligence, the plaintiff's negligence. They never got that far. They just stopped by saying, apparently, that if she was out of the crosswalk, the driver gets off free because she has no duties. One last thing we asked, that the instruction we did request be given, and that was following the California jury instruction that simply says, the jury should be told that although both parties have a duty of care, the effort they make to exercise that care is different. And that's simple. An automobile can do a lot of damage. A pedestrian can't. The pedestrian is at the mercy of the automobile.
Don't you think, though, that might discourage pedestrians? Do we really want to say that the drivers must exercise greater care in terms of we want the pedestrians to exercise high care also.
Absolutely, but think about it, and we all see the
news. And actually, that instruction, when I go back and look at the California case and the Michigan case and the Louisiana case, they all sprung from a time when contributory negligence became a complete bar to plaintiff's recovery.
Right.
So it was really a way for the courts to try to allow plaintiffs to recover. But we don't have pure contributory negligence anymore that is a bar
recovery. That's true, we have comparative negligence, but it's important for drivers to understand that, you know, pedestrians have to wait until it's safe, and sometimes it's impossible for them to get across the street.
Isn't that already part of the court's instruction? The court told the jury, ordinary care is that care which persons of ordinary prudence would under the circumstances. So the circumstances are part of the duty of care.
Absolutely, but the problem is that's legalese. It wouldn't hurt to just add, in a situation with a pedestrian, you gotta be careful because you're driving a dangerous instrumentality.
So we're gonna have a different standard if it's a moped or if it's a motorcycle or if it's a bicycle. Those are all defined as vehicles. Are we gonna have a different standard for it?
I think in those cases it would be appropriate if the plaintiff wanted to submit a proposed instruction, yes.
And so the duty is greater?
No, the duty is the same. It's how you carry out the duty. For example.
Well, according to the instruction you asked, drivers must use more care than a pedestrian. And my question to you, suppose it's a moped or some other vehicle that children use that we see on the sidewalk sometimes. Those are vehicles?
Yes.
I mean, it sounds like to me you're setting up this, by this kind of instruction, levels of hierarchy.
In this case, it would have helped to balance the negative, the erroneous instructions. So it's something to be considered. I'm not saying it was pure error, but I'm just saying an instruction like that in the appropriate case might help. For example, it's different between carrying a stick and carrying a gun. If you drop a stick, nobody gets hurt. If you drop a gun, it could go off. The duty of care, they both have a duty of care, but sometimes you have to be more careful than others. And when it's car versus car, it's different from car versus pedestrian, particularly elderly people are getting.
Wasn't the jury told specifically that that what a reasonable person would do in the same situation and would have foreseen the anticipated injury or damage? That's what they were told.
I agree with you. I agree with you on that. And I'm just saying this is an optional, it's not a requirement.
And there wasn't anything that prevented you from following the argument that Justice Pollack was mentioning, that is the reasonableness of the actions of the parties during the course of the incident. I mean,
none at
certain.
All. Yeah. We could have done that. Okay. I know my time's up. I just want to thank the court. And I also wanted to give you credit for being willing to come out in the community because, you know, we have three branches of government and sometimes people forget that. And I think it's important to know that part of our legal system is that there's enforcement. And we're all grateful for it, so thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you to both of our counsel for participating in our argument today in this very unique venue. We'll be taking this case under advisement, which means we'll decide it at some time in the future, not here as we sit with you here today. But I want to take this opportunity to thank all the people who made this very special event possible, and really just to start on behalf of the court, to thank the students and teachers who are here with us today from Mili Lani High School, from Radford High School, Lelehua High School, Wailua High and Intermediate School, Asset School, Hanalani Schools, and Ho'ala School. You know, the future of our system of government depends on the public understanding our Constitution and the protections it provides and the role of the courts in ensuring those protections. And the dedication and the hard work of the students here today and their teachers who work so hard to help them understand issues of social studies, of the Constitution, of history, is just really amazing. And I think it shows that we'll be in very good hands going forward. So I'd like to ask everyone here to join me in acknowledging these students and especially their teachers. Thank you.
also like to have acknowledge some of our special guests and then extend our appreciation to those folks who helped us be able to put this event on here today. We have among the special guests we have here today are retired Associate Justice Stephen Levinson, a council member, Ron Menor, Representative Marcus Oshiro and his mom, Ruth Oshiro, from the University of Hawaii Richardson School of Law, Dean Avi Soifer, and Associate Dean Renette Kawakami. On behalf of Superintendent Matayoshi, we have Donald and Dela Cruz. And here from the superintendent's office, we have the area superintendent, Dr. John Brumell, and Alyssa Bender as well. From the Hawaii State Bar Association, as you've already heard, Calvin Young, the president, as well as Pat Mao Shimizu, the executive director. And we also have with us here today Jack Tanaki, our state's public defender. So we appreciate all those folks joining us here today and thank them for being here. I also want to thank the many partners who've helped us make this event possible. And really, first and foremost, want to thank the administration and staff here at Mililani High School, Principal Fred Murphy, Vice Principal Andrea Moore, Dr. Amy Peruso, the social studies teacher, just a great teacher we work with in many different contexts, and the great staff here who really have just helped out by helping us set this room up, get people to where they needed to go. They've just been amazing, and I really, really want to thank them. Can you join me in thanking the folks from Mililani High School? I also want to thank some of the other folks who have helped us. I mentioned the University of Hawaii Richardson School of Law. The Students for Public Outreach and Civics Education helped in developing the teaching materials that were used to help explain the issues in this case to the students. They did that in connection with our Judiciary History Center, so I really thank them for all of their hard work. I also and particularly want to thank all of the attorneys from the Hawaii State Bar Association who generously volunteered their time to visit the classrooms, to teach the students about the case, to conduct practice arguments so they could better understand the issues and to assist us with the event here today. We had more than 30 attorneys who joined in that effort, and I extend on behalf of the court our sincere appreciation to each one of them and also to the staff from the Supreme Court and our Judiciary History Center who've been helping here, helping plan the event, and helping here throughout the day today. So can you please join me in acknowledging all of those folks? And finally, I want to thank the leadership of the Hawaii State Bar Association for all they did to work with us to help organize this event, and in particular, to organize the volunteers who came out to teach the case in the schools. As I said, we have Executive Director Pat Mao Shimizu, Calvin Young, the president, and Rebecca Copeland of the appellate section of the Hawaii State Bar Association. A number of members from that section helped out in helping us to plan and stage this event today. And I really want to thank the Hawaii State Bar Foundation for generously providing financial support for the event. The cost of lunches and buses, we couldn't have done that without them. And Tanioka's for providing some of the Ono Eats that we'll be having after the event today and after we have our Q&A and our photographs. So once again, thanks to everyone who helped us out. We're so honored to be here today, so thankful for everyone who helped us, and so thankful for these students and their teachers for being here today and working so hard to prepare for this argument, and we hope that you enjoyed it and hope that you'll enjoy the question and answer sessions that are to come. So there being no further business, this court stands adjourned. Thank you.